Okay, so let's make a start. So welcome to the first of this new seminar series, First Cut, part of our RTG. So this will meet in the gadget slot probably 2 to 3 times a semester. And they're going to be expository lectures on varied topics in geometry and topology. The topics can be, you know, anything from traditional to cutting edge. And they're going to be videoed. So for today, Marong is very kindly videotaping this. In future, we hope to hire a student to do that. No takers so far. I've been thinking of an undergraduate, but a graduate would be fine too. So if you know someone who might be interested, or even better, if you are interested, then please let me know. Okay, so. Right, so this is going to be a lecture about symplectic four-manifolds, some sort of a broad overview of what we know about the structure of symplectic four-manifolds. And we're going to get at that problem by reference to a much better understood one, which is the classification of Kähler surfaces. Okay, so okay, so let's start with some basics. Symplectic four-manifolds, so what is such a thing? It's data x, omega, where x is an oriented, smooth, four-dimensional manifold, and it's equipped with a two-form, omega, so a skew-symmetric bilinear form on each tangent space, and there are two conditions. So one is that the form should be closed, its exterior derivative should kill it. That's a differential condition, it's a differential equation, it's a linear PDE. And the second condition is an open condition, it's a non-degeneracy one. I want the wedge square of omega with itself, so that's a four form, I want that to be nowhere zero. And more precisely, I want it to be positive, measured with respect to the chosen orientation. So that's saying that point-wise, if I think of omega as a skew-symmetric bilinear form, it's non-degenerate in the linear algebra sense. Let me just note here and forevermore that four manifolds are compact and connected in this lecture. So these conditions, d omega equals zero and omega squared positive, are individually not very hard to understand. So both of them can individually be understood through methods of algebraic topology. So d omega equals zero, well, that's so we have a vector space of solutions. We have a large subspace of cheap solutions, namely we could take omega to be d of a one form. And that doesn't quite hit anything, but it only misses a finite dimensional space, which is identified with the second real cohomology of X, which is a purely homotopical and so topological invariant. No dependence on smooth structures, things like that. And the condition that omega squared is positive is a little less familiar, maybe, but you can also get it at algebra topologically through bundle theory, really. It's equivalent to saying that you can promote the tangent bundle of X from what it already is, which is a real vector bundle, to a complex rank 2 vector bundle. And that's a problem that one can attack through bundle theory and characteristic classes, and in dimension 4 it's pretty straightforward. But jointly, these conditions are much more subtle. When you impose both of them, you get a very much more interesting problem. So, for example, the existence of a symplectic form is no longer a homotopical matter. It's very sensitive to things like the smooth structure on your underlying homotopy type. Okay. So there's a large classical class of symplectic four manifolds, and those are the Kähler surfaces. So what are they? Well, okay, so a Kähler surface is, it's a special type of symplectic four manifold. So in the first place, X is now a complex surface. That's to say, it's a manifold, but now it has an atlas of charts that are modeled on open sets in C2 and not merely R4, such that the transition functions are holomorphic. So it's a complex manifold of dimension 2. And then it's supposed to come with this symplectic form omega, and the special thing here is that it should be of type 1-1 with respect to the complex structure. What that means is, if I think in local coordinates z1 and z2, then the sort of terms that I see in omega should be, they should mix a z and a z bar. So I've got here dz1 wedge dz2 bar. I want to make sure that my form is overall real, so I've added to it its conjugate, dz1 bar wedge dz2, and I have some function times that, real function times that. And then I've got dz1 wedge dz1 bar and dz2 wedge dz2 bar. So Kähler forms look like that. But they're symplectic, so they're assumed closed and non-degenerate. And so there are many classical examples. So these are two rather large classes. So for a start, we have the complex tori. So I take C2 and I take some lattice inside it, so some discrete additive subgroup that's isomorphic to Z4. I write down the simplest Kähler form, symplectic form that I can think of on C2, which is this one, basically dz wedge dz bar. And I observe that it's translation invariant and so descends to the quotient. And that then gives me a complex surface with a Kähler form on it. Then there are the projective algebraic surfaces. So what I do is I start with some complex projective space, CPN, and I cut X out by homogeneous complex polynomials, as many as you like, in such a way that I get a surface. CPN carries its Fubini-Studi form, which is this two-form that's, well, its particularly important property is that it has as much symmetry as it possibly could have on CPN, namely it's invariant under the action of the projective unitary group, but it's closed. And if I then restrict that to X, I'll again get a closed form by naturality of the exterior derivative, and because I have a complex submanifold, it'll also be positive. So that gives me a Kähler form on my projective algebraic surface. So there's some overlap between these two classes, of course. Okay. So one key fact about Kähler surfaces is that one knows something about the first Betti number, so the dimension of the first real homology or cohomology, it comes to the same thing. So B1. So here's the theorem. So I've given this in two parts, and the first part is Hodge theory. So I guess it goes back to Hodge himself and perhaps André Weil in the 30s. And it's the assertion that a Kähler surface has even first Betti number. It's an immediate consequence of the Hodge decomposition of cohomology on a Kähler surface. So somewhat later, Kodaira conjectured that if you have a complex surface with even B1, then it should admit Kähler forms. People tried to prove that by a sort of case-by-case analysis, looking at what Kähler surfaces they knew about and to what extent they could classify them. And that project, I think, came to fruition in the early 80s. I think so. Sue completed the picture by showing that K3 surfaces are necessarily Kähler. But, you know, since 1999, there's been a much cleaner way of doing things. So Buchtal and Lamarie independently showed using the theory of currents, that if you have a complex surface with B1 even, then it is a Kähler surface. It admits Kähler forms, and they did it in a completely sort of intrinsic, direct way. But the first difference that was observed between the class of symplectic four manifolds and the subclass of Kähler surfaces was that there's no such parity restriction in the case of symplectic four manifolds. So I'm going to write T2 for the two torus, S1 cross S1. And so there's this famous example which, the story is that this was sort of expounded by Thurston, but actually it had, in a slightly different context, had been found by Kodaira rather earlier. So you can find a symplectic four-manifold X, which in the first place has the structure of a fiber bundle over the two torus, and the fiber is a two torus as well. And the first Betti number is 3. Moreover, this fiber bundle is a symplectic fiber bundle, a symplectic surface bundle, by which I mean the following. So you have your symplectic form on the total space, and you can look at its restriction to any fiber, and I want that to be positive, hence a symplectic form on the fiber. Okay. So those gadgets will come up quite a bit in this lecture. That's why I mention it now. Okay, so that's the sort of first distinction between these two classes. And we'll see that there are a lot of similarities in general and some pretty radical differences. Yes?
I thought there was a long-standing conjecture of whether the sixth sphere was could be a complex structure.
That's true.
But it's got...
This was exclusively about surfaces.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, complex threefolds include an enormous array of weird non-Kähler stuff, twister spaces, all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Yeah, for complex surfaces, so there are some complex surfaces with odd first Betti number, but as soon as the Betti number is even, you have Kähler forms. Okay. So we're going to talk about classification problems. So the basic problem then is to classify symplectic four manifolds in some sense. Well, that problem can take an awful lot of sort of further detail. There are various possible equivalence relations, and I'm not going to go into this in any detail at all, actually. But a typical thing that one would allow is the relation of symplectomorphism. So, in other words, we consider an isomorphism to be a map F from X to Y, which is a diffeomorphism that pulls back the symplectic form of Y to the symplectic form of X. Okay. It's a natural thing. But sometimes it's nice to allow... Some additional equivalences. So, for instance, we can think of taking a symplectic form on a fixed manifold and then varying it in a smooth path of symplectic forms. That's called a symplectic deformation. And sometimes we might want to throw that relation we might want to consider the symplectic forms omega 0 and omega 1 equivalent, and take the equivalence relation generated by both of those. More basic notions. So our sort of inspiration for addressing the classification problem is going to be the Enriquez-Kodaira classification for Kähler surfaces, about which I'll tell you quite a bit more. And so the question is, to what extent does it apply to symplectic four manifolds? And the answer is going to be, well, some of it applies and some of it doesn't. So here's a quick rundown on tools that we have at our disposal. Well, first of all, we have positive ways to construct symplectic manifolds. So cut and paste methods, bundle methods, things like that. Sorts of ideas that gave rise to this Kodaira-Thurston manifold. So I've listed here some figures who've really sort of led the way with each of these techniques, and I think Bob Gompf has really, given us some very powerful methods in that direction. Secondly, we have pseudo-holomorphic curve methods that were initiated by Gromov that are really, you know, hugely powerful. They're the main tool of the subject. But they become still more powerful in conjunction, in symbiosis with Seiberg-Witten gauge theory. So it was a discovery of Cliff Taubes that on a symplectic four-manifold, the Seiberg-Witten equations, which make sense on any smooth four-manifold, actually behave wonderfully well, and they interact with pseudo-holomorphic curves, they give rise to existence theorems for pseudo-holomorphic curves, and they give you a great deal of leverage. And finally, although I won't discuss them in this lecture, there are the Lefschetz pencil methods, coming from approximately holomorphic techniques, which were pioneered by Donaldson. Okay. Okay, so we're now going to start looking a little more closely. And I'm going to begin with an absolutely basic operation in the world of complex geometry generally, in particular complex surfaces, and that's blowing up. So, so if you have a complex surface X and you specify a point little x in it, then there's this specific construction of a new complex surface called the blow-up of x at little x, so denoted with this tilde and a subscript little x. And so I'm not telling you precisely how you construct it if you don't know already, but the key properties are these. So it comes with a holomorphic surjective map pi down to your original surface. That's called the blowdown map. And it has the following properties. So if I, in the base, x, if I look at the complement of my specified point, then over that, the blowdown map is just a bi-holomorphic identification. It's bijective, holomorphic, it has an inverse. Nothing interesting happening there. Everything interesting is happening over x. And the pre-image of x, which I denote by E, it's called the exceptional fiber, is the construction naturally identifies that fiber with a curve, a complex curve, namely the projectivization of the tangent space at x. So the tangent space at x is a little two-dimensional vector space, it's C2. So we look at the projectivization of that, so it's a CP1. Initially, we just have some point little x, and we look at its tangent space. We have a bunch of complex lines through it, and in the blow-up, each of those lines is actually a point in our space. So the effect is somehow that. What in our original manifold is sort of infinitesimal differential geometry at this point is actually seen macroscopically in the blow up. We've sort of zoomed in and made this infinitesimal stuff actually sort of macroscopic. One other thing that's worth saying, because it'll come up all the time, is that so in the blow up we have this. This exceptional curve E, this exceptional P1E, and we can identify its normal bundle. So the normal bundle means we look at tangent vectors to our manifold, our blow-up, along E, and we quotient out by the ones that are tangent to E. And so that's a complex, a holomorphic line bundle over a copy of CP1. And it's a line bundle that's usually called O of minus 1. So that has actually a very natural meaning. So if I think of E as the projectivized tangent space, then if I'm interested in the normal bundle at some point lambda of E, so a point lambda would correspond to a line in the tangent space at x, and what is that line? Well, it's precisely the points of lambda. It's a tautological construction. Okay. So, and the other key thing to know about blowing up is that you can, if someone hands you a complex surface and asks, is it a blow up of something, you can tell by a criterion that goes back well over 100 years, I think. It's due to Castelnuovo. So he says, if you have some complex surface X tilde and you have a smooth rational curve in it, so a CP1 inside it called E, and if it has the right normal bundle, so if the degree of the normal bundle is minus 1, the degree, it's another word for the first Chern class or the Euler class or whatever, then X tilde really did come as a blow up. So, namely, you can find some other complex surface X, a map from X tilde to X that contracts that E to a point and that realizes X tilde as a blow up. So you can recognize blow ups when you see them. So one way that the complex and symplectic categories are very similar is that the story of blowing up works in a rather, a closely analogous way. So for a start, the construction of a blow-up works perfectly well in the symplectic category. Namely, if I have my symplectic four-manifold and I specify a point little x in it, I want to blow it up. So what I do is I just look at a little sort of standard ball, standard Darboux ball in my neighborhood, and I say, well, okay, that's just a copy of C2. And so I can apply my complex geometry construction and just do the blow-up in the sense of complex geometry. And I get a new manifold, and then I ask whether I can also make it symplectic. And the answer is, with a bit of fiddling, you can. The one thing to note is that the construction is no longer completely canonical. The important thing is there's a real positive parameter involved. And what that is that you have to find your new symplectic form omega tilde, and it has some area on the exceptional sphere E. The exceptional two-sphere E. So you can integrate omega tilde over E at some positive number, and that's a parameter of the construction. So the symplectic blow-up looks a little bit unnatural. After all, we've sort of borrowed from complex geometry. We've used holomorphic charts, which is not... doesn't seem a very natural thing to do on a symplectic manifold. But to convince you that this is kind of sensible, We can actually go the other way. So I'd say that blowing down is really natural on a symplectic four-manifold. So it's a sort of surgery operation. So suppose that you have your symplectic four-manifold X tilde, and you see inside it some two-sphere E, so embedded inside it, so it's symplectically, meaning the symplectic form is positive everywhere on it. And suppose it has the right normal bundle, so the degree of the normal bundle is minus 1, what you can do is the following. So you can excise a tubular neighborhood of E. And so the degree determines the topological type of that neighborhood and tells you that when you remove the neighborhood, you'll expose a three-sphere in your manifold, which you can then fill by inserting a four-ball. And in fact, the neighborhood of this symplectic surface is standard also symplectically, which means you can take that three-sphere to look standard symplectically, and you can fill it with a standard symplectic four-ball. So it really makes sense symplectically, and you basically have no choice about how to do it. There's no parameter. Okay. One thing perhaps to say is that there's really no... is that the blow-down map has no nice compatibility with a symplectic structure. Okay. So here's a definition, actually two definitions. A complex surface I'm going to call minimal if you can't blow it down. So I think there's some slight tension with the usage in the minimal model program, so apologies for that, but that's what I mean. So a complex surface is minimal if you can't blow it down, meaning you can't find any minus one spheres, any complex P1s inside it where the degree of the normal bundle is minus one. And similarly, a symplectic four manifold is minimal if you can't blow it down in the symplectic category. You can't find this symplectically embedded two-sphere with self-intersection, with normal bundle of degree minus one. So it's not obvious, but those definitions do actually agree in the Kähler case. In our sort of approach to classification, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to reduce to the minimal case. And the way that goes is the following. You look at your manifold, you say, can I blow it down? And, you know, is there this two-sphere? And if you can, if you can find one, you go ahead and do so. You blow it down. And when you do that, it will have the effect of reducing the second Betti number, B2, by one. So you started with something which has some finite B2, and you blow it down and it reduces. So you can only do that finitely many times before you hit something minimal. Okay, so that's our procedure. Starting from a given x, we blow it down again and again and again until it becomes minimal, which it eventually must do. And that resulting manifold, minimal manifold x prime, is essentially determined by x. There are certain exceptions, they're pretty straightforward, and they're basically the same in the symplectic and the Kähler worlds, complex worlds. But with some exceptions that I'm going to sort of brush aside, we can reduce our classification problem for symplectic or Kähler manifolds to the minimal case and focus our attention on manifolds that don't have these minus one spheres. Right. Okay, so let's talk about the Enriquez-Cordaro classification of complex surfaces or Kähler surfaces. So we're going to focus on minimal ones. And the idea is that we're going to distinguish between them. So we're always going to assume that they're Kähler, or at least B1 is even. It's sort of the same thing. And we're going to try and distinguish between them by the following measure. We're going to look at the canonical line bundle Kx, and we're going to say, how positive is it? Okay, so explanation. So what is Kx? Well, we have the cotangent bundle, T star X, that's a holomorphic vector bundle, in particular complex vector bundle. We can take its determinant, its exterior square, lambda 2, T star X, that's a line bundle, a holomorphic line bundle. That's called the canonical line bundle. And so local sections of this bundle are things that... So this is... local sections in a C-infinity sense are just things that look like some function times dz1 wedge dz2 in local coordinates. So positivity, well, of that thing. What does positivity mean? So that positivity of line bundles is a very extensive topic in algebraic geometry, and they're really a wealth of different but related notions. So what it means for the Cordaro-Enriquez classification is the following. So we take some tensor power of the canonical line bundle. So that's k to the n, that's another line bundle, holomorphic. We look at its space of holomorphic global sections, H0, k to the n. That's a vector space, a complex vector space. We look at its dimension, and we say, how fast does that dimension grow as m goes to infinity? Okay, so when I say how positive, what I'm asking is how fast does that dimension grow? So let's just think that through for the simpler case of Riemann surfaces, complex curves. So in that case, by the canonical bundle, I just understand the holomorphic cotangent bundle. It's one dimensional already, it's a line bundle. And then, so if I look at CP1, well, then the canonical bundle has, it's negative. If you like, it has negative degree. And therefore, if I take a positive tensor power of it, it can have no holomorphic sections at all. H0 is zero. So how do these numbers grow? They flatline on zero. If we look at elliptic curves, so genus 1, so then the canonical line bundle is actually trivial, so all its powers are trivial, and therefore they have only constant sections. So these numbers are just, they flatline again, but on 1 rather than 0. And if we look at genus greater than 1, then that's the case where K really is positive. And then Riemann-Roch rapidly gives you a formula for these dimensions, and you see that they grow linearly with M. They're O of M, exactly O of M. Okay. So this question, how positive is a canonical line bundle, how fast do these spaces grow, it certainly, for curves, tells us something. It gives us the sort of trichotomy between CP1, elliptic curves, and hyperbolic curves, if you like. So we're looking for something like that, but for surfaces. We notice that this trichotomy for curves is very far from a classification of curves. So here's the sort of coarsest part, the first step in this classification scheme. The way I'm phrasing it, it's the negative stroke non-negative dichotomy. I think it's not quite standard terminology. So we're talking about minimal complex surfaces X. And so I'm going to call X Kodaira negative if the space of holomorphic sections of K to the M is identically zero for all positive M. No holomorphic sections for any tensor power. Okay, and otherwise it's Kodaira non-negative. It's a definition. So we'll see. There are several other conditions which are equivalent to this negativity, although it's by no means obvious that they're equivalent. So for that, I need to introduce the canonical class, Kx, without the fancy script. And that's just the first Chern class, or the Euler class, if you like, of the canonical line bundle. So it's a class in the second integer cohomology of X. So you can think of it, if you like, as in Dirac terms, it's the curvature of a connection in Kx. Or if you like Poincaré duality, then you can say that it's the class whose Poincaré dual in second homology is the surface that's cut out as the zeros of a generic section of your bundle. So that's a canonical class. And one equivalent condition which plays a big role in the minimal model program in birational algebraic geometry is, so Kodaira negativity is equivalent to saying that you can find some complex curve C on which the cohomology class Kx evaluates negatively. We're not going to make any real use of that one, but we will use the following. So another equivalent condition uses a Kähler form, which you can take to be any Kähler form you like. And it's a condition that either k dot k is negative, or for each Kähler form omega, you have that k dot omega is negative. I should perhaps clarify that what this dot is. By alpha dot beta for second cohomology classes alpha and beta, I mean that you take the cut product of alpha and beta so as to land yourself in the fourth integer cohomology of X, and then you evaluate on the fundamental cycle of X. Okay, so you can also think of that in Dirac terms as wedging and integrating, or in terms of surfaces as algebraic counts of intersection numbers. Okay, so that's a simple numerical equivalent to negativity. So here's a theorem, maybe phrased in marginally non-standard form, but not much. So you can classify Kodaira negative minimal surfaces. So I'm saying B1 is even here. I guess these people, Castelnuovo and Castelnuovo de Franchis, would have done this in the context of projective algebraic surfaces. So someone more recently extended it to Kähler surfaces, and I don't know precisely who. But anyhow. So part one, so if you have a Cordaro negative surface and K squared is positive, well, you're one of two things. You're either CP2, the projective plane, the sort of most basic compact complex surface, or else you're a holomorphic CP1 bundle over CP1, something pretty straightforward, a ruled surface. And part two, if X is Cordaro negative, but K squared is non-negative, then it's true that you're still a holomorphic CP1 bundle over a curve that might now have higher genus. Okay, so that's our first sort of classification theorem. And so let's think about symplectic analogs of that. So first let's talk about the canonical class, Kx. So we don't have holomorphic charts now anymore. We can't call T star X a holomorphic vector bundle. But we can make it a complex vector bundle. So what we do is we choose this almost complex structure, so an endomorphism of the tangent bundle, which squares to minus the identity. So that's the action of I on tangent vectors, or cotangent vectors. We want to make it compatible with omega. I'm not going to give details, but suffice to say that giving a symplectic structure makes the tangent bundle of X a symplectic vector bundle. Its structure group is the real symplectic group, SP4R. Well, giving it a complex structure is to say it's a complex vector bundle, so a structure group sort of GL2C. Compatible means that you reduce the structure group to the intersection of those two, so the unitary group, U2. So one can find such almost complex structures whereupon I can take the wedge square, the determinant of T star X, as a complex line bundle, not a holomorphic one, and then I can take its first Chern class and call that the canonical class, Kx. That class depends only on the symplectic structure. And so then I can sort of repeat one of these criteria that for negativity that I had and make it a definition. So in a minimal symplectic four-manifold, I'm going to call Cordaro negative. People would usually say Cordaro dimension minus infinity. It's a bit long. If either k dot omega is negative or k dot k is negative. And the remarkable thing is that we have a classification theorem. So this is due to Eichel Yu, but I think it's fair to say that he was building on a lot of other people's ideas, including Gromov's holomorphic curve methods, and which were pushed further by Macduff, Taubes' ideas about Seiberg-Witten theory, and I guess Liu's own work with T.J. Lee, also in Seiberg-Witten theory. And so what Liu proves is that if you have a minimal Cordaro negative symplectic four-manifold, then things look very much like they did in the Kähler case. So if K squared is positive, then X is symplectomorphic either to CP2, with essentially its standard symplectic structure, maybe it's rescaled by something, or to a symplectic two-sphere bundle over the two-sphere. So remember, before we had a holomorphic CP1 bundle over CP1. CP1 is the two-sphere, so it's now a symplectic two-sphere bundle over a two-sphere. And in the second case, we have this isn't completely correct the way I'm phrasing it. But I want to call this Gomp's conjecture. His conjecture was really about the case k squared strictly negative, and here I have non-positive. But in that case, it's still true that, that X is a symplectic two-sphere bundle over some surface. Okay. The phrasing is a little bit funny. I was sort of worried about the case K squared equals zero. Okay, so that's the theorem. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what goes into proving such a thing, because this is, you know, these methods are really central. So essentially we're trying to prove that Kodaira negative manifolds are symplectic two-sphere bundles. Well, they might be CP2, but okay. So what you do, you first pick your almost complex structure, J. So your tangent bundle is complex now. And suppose that we can find a J holomorphic two-sphere C embedded in X. So that means you have a smooth two-sphere embedded in X, and its tangent bundle is invariant under the almost complex structure. Okay, so it becomes an almost complex submanifold. Its tangent bundle is itself complex. And I want this sphere to satisfy certain other desiderata. So, well, I could look at the degree of its normal bundle, and I want that either to be 1, so it looks something like a line in CP2, or to be 0, so that it looks like a fiber of a bundle. Let's look at the latter case. So the degree is 0. So this is a thing that we hope will become a fiber of a bundle. So what you do is, you use the theory of J holomorphic curves to say that you have a whole moduli space, script N, of J holomorphic spheres of the same sort that lie in the same homology class as C. You do a little computation, you convince yourself that that's a two-dimensional moduli space. And you can look at the subset X primed of your manifold, which are filled up by those holomorphic spheres. Which subset lies on some holomorphic sphere? That's an open subset, basically by the Fred Holm theory that goes into setting up this moduli space in the first place, in a nice way. And secondly, well, okay, I need to assume a bit more. I'm going to assume something like that the area, the symplectic area of C is as small as it could possibly be, so that my curves can't somehow break. And now if I do that, I have a Gromov compactness theorem that's going to tell me that X primed is also a closed subset of X. So it's both open and closed. So it's equal to X, it's connected. Okay, so I've now filled up my whole manifold with these holomorphic spheres under the assumption that I could find one of them in the first place. What's more, no two of the spheres in this moduli space intersect one another. And that's because if you have a pair of J holomorphic curves, then their local intersection multiplicities are always positive. So it's easier to think of the transverse case, you know, two complex subspaces of C2, the orientation is positive, they count with a positive sign. You always have positive local intersection multiplicities. On the other hand, if you look at the algebraic intersection number, the signed count of intersections, well, that's equal to the degree of the normal bundle, which is 0. So we have this positive count equal to 0. It can't happen. No intersections. So now we conclude that every point on our manifold lies on a unique holomorphic sphere from this moduli space. And so we can define a map from X to our moduli space, just mapping a point to the unique curve on which it lives. And that's a symplectic two-sphere bundle. So easy as that. Okay. Except, you know, where on earth did this C come from in the first place? If we were in some standard manifold like CP2 or something, then as Gromov discovered, you can show that sort of independently of your choice of J, such curves exist. But we're on this sort of unknown target manifold. We only know some very basic things about it. You need magic. And so you need the Seiberg-Witten equations. So it's this sort of amazing tool which somehow produces for you A J holomorphic sphere in of the right kind. I'm not really going to go into what the Seiberg-Witten equations are. These comments in blue are sort of for experts.
Is it hard to get curves of a higher genus, or is it?
Sorry.
But if we want.
Yeah. So. You mean as the base or as the fiber?
Just through a point. Are there lots of J holomorphic curves if you just.
No. Well, I mean, on these kinds of manifolds, no, surely.
If it's a variety, you just.
I mean, you know, the Seiberg-Witten equations help you find certain holomorphic curves. You have to look closely at the precise situation. The arguments here are certainly.
In Mori theory, what you do is you start with, because it's a variety, you have loads of curves. You take one, and then you do some deformation stuff to bend and break.
And bend and break is the one thing that we would love to be able to do in symplectic geometry and have no clue, because Mori uses these positive characteristic methods. Somehow this is a completely different one, and it sometimes gives you amazing existence theorems for holomorphic curves. And on these Kodaira negative manifolds, it allows you to get lots of holomorphic two spheres, broadly speaking. A remark to the experts is that somehow what you do is that you say that the Seiberg-Witten equations have these very cheap solutions that come from they're sort of abelian instantons, but then. Taubes tells you how to deform the equations and to deform the solutions with them, and in some geometric limit they become far from cheap and they localize on along holomorphic curves and thereby prove existence of holomorphic curves. It's pretty amazing. And in particular, the case where k squared is negative, this Castelnuovo de Franchi's theorem is usually proved by recourse to a construction in algebraic geometry called the Albanese variety, the Albanese torus, and you certainly don't have that here. But somehow the abelian instanton solutions to these equations function as the Albanese torus. I think it's sort of incredible. Anyhow, okay, so as far as this lecture is concerned, it's magic, but I recommend you read up on it. It's very nice stuff. Okay, so that's the Kodaira negative case. All right, so. So. Let's move now to Kodaira non-negative manifolds. And here we're going to need to refine our classification. So we're going to split those manifolds into three slightly finer classes by means of the Kodaira dimension. So what is it? So we take our minimal complex surface X and we define its Kodaira dimension, cod of X, as follows. So we define Pn to be the dimension of the space of holomorphic sections of K to the N. It's called the nth plurigenus. And we look at how fast the Pns grow, as I sort of said we would. So we take the lim sup of log Pn over log N. So that means that, for instance, if Pn is a quadratic function, then the Kodaira dimension will be 2. If it's polynomial growth of degree d, the dimension will be d. So Kodaira negative, that's the case when all the plurigenera are 0, and in that case the Kodaira dimension is minus infinity. So we're talking about non-negative ones now, and it turns out there are only three possibilities, Kodaira 0, 1, or 2. So 0 means that the sup of the plurigenera is just 1. And that's equivalent to the assertion that the canonical class is a torsion cohomology class in H2. So it's either 0 or it's some multiple of it is 0. Kodaira 1 means that Pn grows linearly. And Kodaira 2 means that Pn grows quadratically. And those are the only options, it turns out. Roughly as a consequence of Riemann-Roch. And so let's look at Kodaira dimension 0. So here's what Enrico's Kodaira tell us, but this has been sort of supplemented by hard and more recent sort of Torelli-type theorems. Um, so So if we have a complex surface with kx torsion, oh, I don't even need to say minimal anymore, because if it weren't minimal, it wouldn't have kx torsion. So then it's one of the following few types. So it could be a K3 surface. That means that K is dead-on trivial, 0. And the first Betti number is 0. So that's the definition of a K3 surface. There's then this deep theorem that tells us that there's only one deformation class of these things. That deformation class includes, for instance, a quartic surface in CP3. And I should say here that by a deformation class, it means that you're allowed to vary the complex structure on a fixed differentiable manifold. Then there are the Enriquez surfaces. So in this case, B1 is still 0. The canonical class is non-trivial, but twice the canonical class is trivial. Again, there's only one deformation class of these. There are the complex tori that we discussed before. Again, one deformation class. And then there are a few others. So they're bi-elliptic and Kodaira surfaces. These things are holomorphic fiber bundles. The base is an elliptic curve. And the fiber is, well, it's at least a genus 1 curve. Don't want to say anything about whether it has a section, so I'm not saying elliptic curve. There are several deformation classes of those things. They're not all Kähler, but they're well understood. So it's a pretty tight classification in that setup. And now let's turn to the symplectic case. And whilst dimension of the holomorphic sections makes no sense in the symplectic world, the condition that Kx is torsion is perfectly straightforward. Makes perfectly good sense symplectically. So that's what we mean by symplectic Kodaira dimension 0. And so there's a conjecture. Actually, I haven't given an attribution, and I'm not really sure who first suggested it. But it's that if you have a symplectic four-manifold with torsion canonical class, then it's at least up to diffeomorphism, probably a bit more than that, but at least up to diffeomorphism, it's a K3 surface, an Enriquez surface, or a symplectic torus bundle over a torus. Remember, that includes that weird Kodaira-Thurston manifold with B1 equal to 3, which wasn't Kähler. But these holomorphic torus bundles over tori fit into this class. What's the evidence? A couple of things, and I'll tell you one very strong piece of evidence. It's a theorem of Stefan Bauer and independently Tianjun Li, generalizing Morgan-Savo. And it says that for such a manifold, symplectic with Kx torsion, what we can say is that B plus is at most 3. And it follows that B1 is at most 4. So what's B plus? So B plus, you look at, the second Durham cohomology, you have a quadratic form on it, which, so Q of a closed two-form alpha is the integral of the wedge square of alpha. And you look at the dimension of a maximal space on which that form is positive definite. Okay, that's B plus. It's a topological invariant, or homotopical invariant of X, in fact. So for instance, for a K3 surface, that would be 3. For an Enriquez surface, it would be 1. You can compute it for these T2 bundles as well. It's always less than or equal to 3, and that's actually true for these torsion, these Kodaira 0 symplectic manifolds. The proofs are subtle. So they use Seiberg-Witten theory again. Remarks are here again sort of for experts. So we use quaternionic symmetry of the Seiberg-Witten equations on a spin manifold. We use Bauer-Ferruter's homotopical refinement of the theory. We use Taubes's canonical Seiberg-Witten solution on a symplectic manifold. Okay, so that's a repetition of the same conjecture, a restatement. So maybe you can just demolish this conjecture by constructing something. I think it'll have to be pretty weird such a construction. Standard things definitely won't work, but maybe you can demolish it. Otherwise, it seems pretty hard. But I do want to propose a weaker conjecture, which might just be a bit more accessible. So if someone, wants a pretty ambitious thesis project, then you could try the following. So suppose that kx is torsion, and that the first Betti number is less than or equal to 1. That's going to rule out those torus bundles. Then the claim is that twice the canonical class is 0, as it would be for K3 and Enrico's surfaces. So just maybe that's accessible to Seiberg-Witten theory. Okay, up one. Cadara dimension 1. So in Cadara dimension 0, the Kähler and symplectic manifolds were very definitely different, but maybe they're not that different. Cadara dimension 1, they're very different. So for a complex surface, this means that Cadara dimension 1 means that the plurigenera grow sort of linearly, they grow like AM plus B. And there's this sort of wonderful construction in algebraic geometry. So you can build this variety just from nothing. In this case, you can build a curve. And what you do is we're interested in these spaces of holomorphic sections of tensor powers of K. So we take the sum of all of those. Now, you can multiply two such sections together and get another such section, and it becomes a graded ring. And then there's this just completely abstract construction of this scheme, this variety, prod of that graded ring built from its homogeneous prime ideals. And in this case, it's going to be a curve. And it comes with a map from your x to that curve. And, well, if you play with that construction, tweak it a bit, so as to make the fibers of the map connected, things like that, then what you prove is the following. You can find if X has Cadara dimension 1, then you can find a holomorphic map from X to a complex curve B with the property that KX is trivial on the fibers. Okay, so the fibers then, they end up being Riemann surfaces with trivial canonical bundle, so they're genus 1 curves. And actually you can find a section, so they're elliptic curves. Okay, so such things are called surfaces which have such a map whose sort of smooth fibers are elliptic curves are called elliptic surfaces. They also have singular fibers, which one can study. And, you know, the deformation classes of these elliptic surfaces have been classified. It's a complicated story, but it was doable. In the symplectic case, it's not so. So I'm going to call a minimal symplectic four-manifold of Cadara dimension 1 if k dot omega is positive, but the key thing is k squared is 0. Okay, so it agrees with the usual definition in the Kähler case. But now things are very different from the Kähler case as regards classification. So we have this theorem of Gompf, which, you know, really illustrates very dramatically that the symplectic world is totally different from the Kähler world in general. So you give yourself some finite group presentation, so some generators, some relations, finitely many of each, presenting a group G. So the claim is that you can construct this minimal symplectic four-manifold, P was supposed to be the presentation, so you can construct this minimal manifold X sub P, Cadara dimension 1, in such a way that it sort of comes with an isomorphism of its fundamental group with G. So in particular, you can realize this arbitrary fundamental group here, which you absolutely cannot do in the Kähler world. So that, again, this is just a restatement of the theorem. One upshot is the following. So suppose we try to distinguish homotopy types of four manifolds, but only those that admit symplectic forms. Well, the thing is, there's a sense in which that's an algorithmically unsolvable problem because of Bob's theorem. And that's because if you had such an algorithm, then it would be able in particular to decide whether the fundamental groups of these things were trivial. And so it would decide whether a given presentation presents the trivial group. And because of that, this algorithm would have, hiding inside it, a universal Turing machine. It would have such an algorithm would have the capability to solve Turing's halting problem. It would say, you know, you take this sort of primitive computer and you ask whether you can tell algorithmically whether it will stop eventually when you feed it a given computer program and a given numerical input. Turing's theorem is that no such algorithm exists, and if you could sort of classify symplectic four manifolds, you'd find a nestling somewhere in there this solution to the halting problem. So it can't be done. Of course, if you knew more about the geometry of your X, then you might be able to say much, much more. This is saying that, you know, in a vacuum, if you know essentially nothing about X, you can't classify. I'm not going to say how Bob constructs these things, other than to say that it uses a surgical method pretty much like the one that we use to blow down a symplectic four manifold. It's called symplectic sum. So what you do is you start with a product of a two torus and a surface of some of genus K, that was the number of generators of your group, and then you want to sort of start killing off generators of pi 1 corresponding to the relations of your group. And you do that by a clever symplectic surgery operation involving sort of symplectic sums along tori with some standard manifold that's going to have the effect of killing pi 1. Lastly, we come to Godara dimension 2, also known as general type. So these are the minimal surfaces where the plurigenera grow quadratically, which is as fast as they can, by Riemann-Roch. And in a certain sense, well, in some sense, most surfaces have general type. So for instance, if you look at hypersurfaces in CP3, just cut out by a single homogeneous polynomial of some degree D, you know, there are the exceptional cases where the degree is 1, 2, 3, or 4, and then all the rest are general type. And usually when you have some construction with a parameter like that, most of them will be finite, will be general type. So, disappointingly, there's no classification. But there are at least finiteness theorems. So there's a theorem which I've attributed to Grothendieck and Bombieri, which says that suppose you fix these numbers k dot k and E, so E is just the topological Euler characteristic, not the holomorphic one, the topological one. Then those numbers are shared by only finitely many deformation classes of general type surfaces. Okay. It's proved using Hilbert schemes.
Oh, sorry, what do you mean by deformation here? I mean, wouldn't the topological Euler characteristic be the same if you deform any symplectic?
Yes, absolutely. So these are invariants. So within a deformation type, these numbers are the same, but there are only finitely many deformation classes. So.
Oh.
So we at least have some sort of control, some finiteness. We also have this sort of geographical control. Let me put a light on and draw a little picture on the board here. So we have some inequalities. So I'm going to plot E on this axis and k dot k on this one. And then, so first of all, it's sort of rather easy to see that Godara dimension 2 implies that k squared is positive. Then you have this Noether inequality, which means rather little to me, I must say, which is some line like that. And we're only allowed to be on this side of it. And then we have this BMY, Bogomolov-Miyako-Yao inequality, which goes here. It says that k squared is at most 3 times the Euler characteristic. And so the region that you can fill up, or attempt to fill up, is this one. Okay. Certainly, you know, the different proofs of the BMY inequality involve lots of sort of very remarkable and interesting mathematics. So in the symplectic case, so I'm going to say that you have symplectic Cordaro dimension 2 if k dot omega is positive and k squared is positive. Okay. And it turns out that actually exhausts, you know, every minimal symplectic manifold does belong to one of the types. And again, this agrees with the Kähler usage. And, you know, so like Cordaro dimension 1, these manifolds are pretty wild. So pi 1 is completely unconstrained once again. We know very little. So you know, you can think, what interesting invariants do you have? And you cook some up, and you find that practice, they're pretty boring. Like Gromov-Witten invariants seem to be a great candidate, and they get you very far. For instance, at least in the Kähler case, they somehow localize along a canonical curve, and they're not very good invariants in this case. We can ask about whether these geographical constraints hold, these inequalities. And so Noether's inequality, the one over here, is just false. It's not very difficult to come up with examples. What about BMY, this k squared less than or equal to 3e? Well, I'm not sure who first suggested this, and I think it might have been Fintuschl and Stern. Certainly the two Rons have talked about it. Standard open conjecture. We really don't know. So that's a big open problem. And I'm on to my last slide now. So let's wrap this up and give a summary. So the story is, in both cases, you sort of reduce your classification to the somewhat simpler case of minimal manifolds, and that reduction works essentially in the same way in both cases. We then have this negative non-negative dichotomy, and for the negative ones, in both cases you have S2 bundles, you have 2-sphere bundles, well, in CP2. It's much the same in the two cases. Cordaro dimension 0, those were the ones where the canonical class is torsion. That's really the cusp, the limit of our understanding, I would say, in the symplectic case. So there might be a simple classification, which would be pretty close to the Kähler one, or it might be that we're just completely off. Symplectic Cordaro dimension 1 is sort of wild. Pi 1 is unconstrained. Maybe it's better if we assume that pi 1 is trivial, but I don't think we know very much about that. And in Cordaro dimension 2, it's also wild, but I think that there are these, you know, this symplectic BMY conjecture is something that we ought to address. It seems very interesting, and it's possible that sort of methods from nonlinear elliptic PDE will actually get us somewhere with that. Okay, so thank you. That's all. Questions?
Is there any good notion of minimal and higher dimensions?
No, don't think so.
You can sort of try. You know, the only thing you know is
actually
time k to omega. That would be. You would just be have some examples. I mean, omega.
Yeah, right. So
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, so can you, yeah, so this is K not being nef, something like something along.
Well, negative nef is what you want to be.
Right. Yeah. So one can certainly do sort of birational geometry in
well, I was going to say the easiest and the coolest, I mean, the sort of first really good theorem in birational geometry is that that if the, you know, that PN is the only thing that has an ample tangent.
Absolutely. So there are great open problems related to that. So, for instance, suppose I have a sort of Fano symplectic manifold, by which I mean that suppose that the canonical class is a negative multiple of the symplectic class.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, so then, yeah, okay, right. Right. And suppose that, what's it called? I think it's called the index in Mori.
Yeah.
So suppose that the minimal Chern number of spheres in your manifold, maybe holomorphic. So suppose that that's can that ever be greater than the dimension plus one? And if it's equal to the dimension plus one, can you be anything other than projective space? We don't know. Bend and break fails. We don't know what to do.
That hard theorem is pretty hard, even in, you know, the other mm-hmm. thing is a lot easier than more, you think.
Mm-hmm. Right. No? Okay, thank you.